My name is Michael Lawrence. I'm an audio engineer. I spend a lot of time on the phone with people who are very experienced and have been in the audio field for longer than I've been alive, and they have incredible amounts of knowledge and inspirational comments and really interesting and exciting viewpoints. And none of this was codified anywhere. This is stuff you can't find in books. And this is stuff that I felt strongly that should be preserved for the future of audio to guide myself as I age and I move forward in audio and on other people, younger people who are coming into the field and as the field develops. This is stuff that I felt very strongly that is important to our heritage in audio engineering, and I wanted to find a way to preserve it. So I said, hey, I'm just going to call people up that I like, and I'm going to let them talk, and we're going to preserve that and allow other people to benefit from it. And the first conversation you're going to hear is a conversation with my friend Bernie Broderick, who is an extraordinarily passionate audio engineer and has a bunch of really interesting ideas and is always inspirational and fun to talk to. And when I explained to him what I was doing, he said, yes, absolutely. I'd love to be part of it. And so I'm not going to preamble anymore. We're going to jump right into the recording. And I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thank you.
You might think that Truth in Audio was started as a training academy, and training academy is what we would call our tree trunk, right? So it's the basis from which we want to, flower outwards and touch, you know, many different aspects of the industry. My sister, who's the general manager, Bernadette, she told me, because when we first got together on this and we started talking about it, we did 13 pages of notes as to how many ideas we had for the business. And the training academy was the first, you know, major nugget, because that's where I'd come from. I'd done 20 years of training, and it seemed like the natural, you know, center point for the business. But, you know, my head was flooded with so many other things that I wanted to do. And a lot of it was predicated on historical value of our industry, my concern about the commoditization of our industry, the constant barrage of digital technology without giving any consideration for, you know, its use or its control. There were so many things that I wanted to spit out, you know, all at the same time. And working with Keith, of course, with Live Sound Magazine has been very good for me, because it gives me a chance to sit down and put some of these thoughts on paper. But, I've said it before, I'll stand in front of anybody at any time to talk about this stuff. I'm very, very passionate, about it. And, so this, you know, what I've seen over the last, we're really going back to VDOSK, right? So when I was with L-Acoustics, joined up and, was part of this paradigm shift in live sound. And, you know, I was just amazed at, first of all, what the products could do. And then I was amazed at the level of interest that our community, our audio community, had in this technology. And so I was on a real high, what they say, you're at the pointy end of the spear, right? And I was out teaching these people as the VDOSK instructor for North America. And I was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of guys, and they were like lining up down the block. And then as line arrays kind of proliferated and succeeded in our industry, I started to notice, you know, kind of a slow and steady decline of innovation. You know, we had guys coming up with new horn designs, new waveguide designs, maybe a new rigging design, but the basic topology of the system structure was repeat. And, you know, whereas I used to go to trade shows originally and be incredibly enthusiastic to run around and see what everybody was doing, that enthusiasm started to wane after a while, because I knew, you know, when I showed up at an Infocom or whatever, I wasn't going to see anything radical in loudspeaker technology. I wasn't going to see anything that was like groundbreaking. And what I started to see was duplication, you know, taking line array physics, let's call it that, and, you know, taking what it is maybe three or four simple acoustic principles and applying them. And, you know, you couldn't get away with this with old trapezoid systems, right? I mean, it was like a PA for the day back then. Every PA was different. Every approach was different, you know, and I don't know. I think it was because there was far more to consider. There was far more ingredients to making a point source system function in large scale, you know, coupling and deployment and stuff like that.
Well, and now, let me ask you this then, because, you know, like you and I have talked about in the past, and I think you've written, you know, the basic idea of a line array, you know, like you said, there's four basic elements and they go in a box. And I was asked, you know, I was on Nathan Lively's podcast a couple of weeks ago, and the question was, what's next? What's the big paradigm shift? And what we're seeing is, you know, incrementally lighter, incrementally faster to rig, incrementally lower distortion, incrementally higher SPL. But I don't, you know, what's the next big step? You know, what do you see? I think spatial's something worth talking about.
Well, yeah, I totally would love to talk about spatial. But as far as loudspeakers are concerned, at least concert level loudspeakers, that is the question, because you can go to trade shows now. And I mean, it's no secret that a lot of manufacturers in the United States and in Europe even use China for manufacturing, right? So China over the decades has bought, you know, American CNC machines. They've been trained by Americans. They've used American innovation. They've set up, they've got huge factories, but they also have incredibly low wages for their people. So, I mean, there's two hands, a set of eyes and a brain, right? So anybody with the proper training and skill can put together the stuff that we do. It's not overly complicated. Where the country, and I don't mean to say just China. I mean, there's other places, there's Mexico, there's India, there's several places that get our business, let's say, as an industry, due to low wages and the low delivery price of the product to our shores. But it's only a matter of time before, you know, they say these people smarten up. And what I've seen over the last 5 years, at least, is that they have smartened up and they understand now what the principles of building a line array are. And they have all the parts and they have all the tools. At one point, we were kind of protected as manufacturers of loudspeakers due to patents, things like the DOSC waveguide, you know, were heavily coveted by Elacoustics. And you just couldn't do it the way they did it, or else you'd get sued. But that patent's run out, and now you can buy similar waveguides to a DOSC waveguide right off the shelf. I mean, with the driver attached. So the high frequency section, which was always the big stumbling block for manufacturers to try to overcome, because, you know, there's nothing to making the mid and low work in this category, right? You just get the step distance correct and you set crossover points correctly, and, you know, you're pretty much off to the races. It was the high frequency that was the challenge, and that's not a challenge anymore. So you've erased the only real challenge of building a line array. And I don't know about you, I'm sure you have, but at the last several trade shows that I've been to, we are now seeing Chinese brands of line arrays, right? So we're actually seeing not them doing OEM business with our, you know, established brands. They're doing it by themselves. And I've looked at a number of these systems. And when I go to Music Mesa, it's much more broad, because you have every Tom, Dick, and Harry, you know, trying to throw together a line array, some with some success, some not. But here in the United States, the companies that I've seen show up here, meaning that they have marketing money, they have the ability to be able to bring their stuff here, it's done pretty damn good. You know what I mean? Like, it's done really, really well. And it's not that difficult. I guess that's the point. So to summarize that whole thing, I think that as an industry in loudspeakers, the entire loudspeaker design industry has gone to sleep. It's absolutely gone to sleep. And it's been asleep for quite a while. When I worked for EAW and we came out with Adaptive, I thought that this was like, oof. You know, I was at the tip of the spear again, right? Like, this was going to be incredible. It was going to take the world by storm. I was surprised to walk into a lukewarm reception. A lot of confusion, misconception, redirect. a lot of people who immediately out of the gate dismissed it and said it's, you know, it's wrong. And even competitors were saying it was wrong. But the truth is that the stuff really does work, and it really does do what it advertises. But where is the attention? You know, where is the industry kind of focus on this stuff? Because I had a friend of mine, you know, Matthew McQuaid, right?
I don't know him personally.
Well, he was one of the systems guys that I worked with on Tom Petty, on Tom's last tour when Scovel went out and took out the adaptive rig. And, you know, he was hesitant, like most people are. New technology, didn't understand it, had Martin MLA experience, but he had never used this stuff. And Vic Wagner, who now works for L Acoustics, was the lead tech in the system. Both of those guys were very reserved about their opinions on this stuff. After a while, they really came to love the PA. They really bought into it. You know, they got used to it. They knew exactly all the nuances. But in those days of touring with Matt, I remember one day talking about this very topic about our industry and where we're headed. And Matt's like in his, I don't know, mid-20s, 24, 25, something like that. And we were talking about adaptive and kind of like the lack of attention it got in the industry, given what he now knew. And he told me, he said, I'm afraid, really, because if a system like this, if this technology doesn't succeed in the marketplace, like if it doesn't really ingrain itself in the marketplace and people, whether willingly or unwillingly, make it go away, let's say, and that's not going to happen, but let's just say hypothetically it does. What kind of industry are we left with, right? Like, what are we left with if something, you know, completely different and radical comes out and the industry just goes, no, I think I'll just stick to my old traditional linery boxes. I don't want your new tech. I don't want your whiz bang stuff. I just want to, you know, do the same old, same old. And by and large, I mean, that's out there. That opinion is certainly out there, and it's frightening. It frightens me. So part of the mandate for Truth in Audio, you know, one of the backbone pieces of starting this company is to try and make sure that doesn't happen, right? Like we want to promote, when we teach people, we talk a lot about stuff like that, about innovation, about new stuff. The Axie Periodic is a good example. The Celestion compression driver, which I'm baffled all the time that people don't know about it. Like they've never heard of it. And I'm like, well, it's like the coolest thing that's come out in at least the last 2 years that I can think of.
Attribute that to then? Because if you see, well, I mean, you see a broad slice of the industry. Do you see, is it maybe generational with generally older people that have been around the horn a couple of times saying, I what I'm doing works and I'm not interested in new technology? And do you see more young people saying, oh, I'm really interested in this? Or, I mean, or where's that divide?
Well, certainly there's two things at play here. One is minor and one is major. The first one is the generational transition, right? So we have guys in my age, you know, 50 years old and older, who some of us are still very creative and still very engaged and certainly want to see the needle continue to move. But others, God bless them all. I mean, they're tired. They were on the road touring while you guys were all learning networks. Right. And they were swinging boxes and they were in tour buses and bunks. And now this is kind of thrown in their faces, you know, in the 11th hour of their careers and saying, well, if you don't, you know, if you don't understand how to set up a network, then, you know, I'm going to pass on you with all of your wealth of experience. And I'm going to take this younger guy who has a fraction of your experience only because he knows how to do this sort of thing. And so there's a natural tendency then to want to resist anything that poses that question, right? Mm-hmm. Or poses right. that potential. The second part of it, which I think is a major component, is the huge influence that corporations have had on brands. So you have so many brands out there, these iconic brands that were all family owned, privately owned during the 80s, you know, 70s and 80s. And then one by one, they got gobbled up by corporations, you know, people looking to, you know, turn a fast buck, investors, and they answer to people, the people that run these businesses and own these businesses, they answer to investors. So if you've done any research on corporations in general, they don't like risk. So they stay away from risk. And if I were to walk into a CEO's office and say, hey, I have just like redefined sound. It's this crazy space age widget that that will change the face of audio. The response I'd get from probably about, you know, 90% of these people would be, who else makes it and how many have they sold? Right? So it's a completely different mindset. It's not about moving the needle of our industry. They actually don't, by and large, a lot of them don't even care. They don't even know what you're doing. And the investors have absolutely zero clue what you're doing. What they want is a return on their investment. And the easy way to do that is to not take risk, right? So you don't take any risks in the hope that you're going to create the next latest and greatest thing. I think that the answer to that is going to be smaller boutique companies. You know, it's not going to come. I don't think it's going to come from the big brands. I really don't. I think it's going to come from small, exclusive boutique companies that are going to slow burn, you know, but they're really focused on innovation. They know that that's the key, that if they produce something that's unique and different, that it'll bring attention. They can't fight, you know, head to head with companies that have millions of dollars at their disposal for marketing and offshore resources. They can't. All they can rely on is having something so unique and cool that they find their own little niche market, right?
Right. And, you know, so what comes to mind, one example, when we were out at the loudspeaker demo a couple months ago, the Elconch stuff, you know, they're saying we're going to make these tiny little boxes that have these high frequency ribbon drivers and absolutely keep pace with the bigger stuff and sound great. That's, you know, cool. Like you said, it's a niche, it's a specialty, you know, product. And so you're not going toe to toe with a K2 box at that point. You know what I mean?
Right.
But you're going to have people that say, yeah, this is what we want. And I can also, you know, I think there's a momentum aspect to it as well. If you think of it from the point of view of maybe a local original production company, you know, where you've got a 10-year-old rig maybe, and you say, well, look at this new fancy new rig. But then you really go, right, but mine's already paid off and I can get the same results. You know what I mean? So is this investment going to make me more money? And a lot of times for companies, the answer is no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's other issues at play there when rental companies buy sound systems. Like when I have my own production company back in Canada, B2 Systems, at the time, everybody was into the KF-850. Everybody, you know, every rider was topped off with the AW KF-850. And when I was building my company up, this drove me insane because I always wanted to be unique. I wanted to do things that my interpretation, because I've also got a big history in racing too. We've talked about this and finding your own strengths and weaknesses in racing is paramount, right? You can't, you know, this whole idea of stock racing and, you know, rider against rider. I mean, it's great for the rider, but it's horrible for the teams because if they're all running the same bikes with the same equipment, you know, it's really, really difficult to find a niche that, you know, you can get over the competition. When we were racing in Moto America and pro, you know, we were, you know, working out of the back of a pickup truck, basically racing against teams with three semis and 10 crew, you know? And so you're talking millions of dollars of equipment versus, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of equipment. And we had to find ways to compete. So with B2 Systems, I went with TurboSound instead of EAWs. And I did that on purpose because I figured, you know, with the blue boxes, they were easy to identify. And I could really stake my claim on my service, on my, you know, my knowledge, my crew, and not have to worry about competing against everybody else that had the same rig. And that's a huge problem these days. I mean, a lot of the sales guys for rental companies are not selling anymore. You know, you have this whole thing of, yeah, we'll buy your PA, give us a tour. You know, like, I'm not interested if you don't provide tours with the system. Wait a minute, I'm not an agent, right? I sell PA.
Right. Right.
And so by and large, the workload for a lot of the stuff these days goes more into promoting the fact that you have a certain brand, and then you just wait. You know, you say I have L Acoustics, you say I have Meyer, you say I have Adamson or whatever, and then you wait for the people who are looking for that stuff to come into your store. it wasn't that way. You know, when I had my production company, man, I had to go out and pound the pavement and sell my company, not sell the speaker brand that I had. So when it comes to touring companies, this is by and large the model for the larger companies. They're all candy stores, most of them. They'll buy any PA, any PA in the market. It doesn't matter. If you're bringing a tour with it, if there's an engineer that's asking for that rig and they have a lot of money sitting on the table, they'll certainly do it. They'd be foolish not to. What is more interesting is what regional companies do, right? The smaller regional companies, they can't compete at that level. They can't go out and buy, you know, $1.5 million worth of K1 or something like that. They just can't do it.
Right.
So they have to rely more on sales skills, and they have to rely more on building relationships and trying to grab some of these bands as they're up and coming, and hopefully they'll take them to the next level. So I think that the regional companies are the ones that will propagate new technology, because they don't, you know, it'll be a smaller company that will buy Alcons. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Not because it can't sit with a big company, because it certainly can. But in that structure, that model that I just described, unless Alcons were to walk into one of these big rental companies and say, "Hey, we've got this giant tour," you know, they probably won't get a sale. And that's not just Alcons; that's anyone. You know, EAW. We went through the same stuff when I was with the brand. You know, like, bring us a tour, and we'll certainly look at your stuff. So it's not exclusive; it's broadband, but these smaller regional companies who are trying to make a name for themselves, and they know they can't compete like in that arena, they will rely more on uniqueness and building their own, you know, approach to doing things. And I think that's kind of a long-winded summary of kind of where I see. It's my personal opinion, but it's where I see the chess pieces right now. And
I think it's
never a problem, by the way. It's never a problem for me. Everything is always an opportunity.
Right. I think there's a question of scale that you bring up. It's really interesting to me, because I do a lot of local regional stuff, and my colleague does local regional stuff, and we, you know, together handle most of the events that you know, provide my income. And I am not a rental company. I don't own PAs. I don't own racks and stacks, and I have just enough gear that I need to go out and do my job. So I have a system processor and I have a console, and that way I can go in and, you know, and so really, what am I selling? I'm selling a service. I'm not selling a product. You know what I mean? And exactly. And if you say, "Hey, we need a big PA," I will get on the phone and I will get you one.
You'll find it.
You know what I mean? If you need a video wall, you need a stage roof. I don't have those things, but I can get them for you. Why am I being hired and not the next person? And I think a lot of that has to do with personal relationship. Like you said, it's about skill set. It's about someone. I think there's a huge peace of mind, particularly for, I do a lot of college corporate type things, and they just want it to go well. They want it to work. They don't want to deal with it. And so one of the things that, you know, one of my repeat clients says to me is, they say, "We love working with you because as soon as we tell you we're doing the show, we send you the info. We don't worry about it. You don't bug us about it. You handle it. You make it happen." That's one less thing that the promoters have to worry about. And there's a real value there. And so people willing to pay for that peace of mind to know that, Michael's going to handle that aspect of it, so we can go and worry about the other things. And I think that is a big piece of that puzzle.
Well, I mean, who's done that better than anybody else at the highest level of touring? Fair Brothers.
Right.
They own that arena. I mean, you know, I mean, it's no secret that, you know, over the years, Clare Brothers has, you know, since the S4s, they've come out with several line arrays. They've been on that track for a while. And I think it's fair to say that despite the magnitude of their touring prowess, they had a difficult time trying to compete against the likes of L-Acoustics and brands like that. They were never regarded as the market leader for line arrays. Still not to this day. You know, they don't fill those top spots. But what they do in spades, what they do to perfection, is sell the total package. So you'll have many touring groups out there who will use Clare Brothers, despite the fact that it may not be the speaker box that they would prefer, but you get their crew, you get their organization, you get their logistics, you get their worldwide presence. And, you know, it has nothing to do with the gear. Right. It really doesn't. Right. You know, you can get the majority of the stuff that Claire has outside of their proprietary speakers and things like that. You can get them from anywhere, but you're certainly not going to get their people. You're not going to get their support. You know, I won't even get into, you know, purchasing power and things like that. But, that was a real model for me back when I was, you know, putting my production company together. I didn't want to be a brand house. I wanted to be a Claire Brothers. I wanted to be a Shoko. You know, I wanted people to come to me because they heard about us word of mouth. And what you're describing too, it exists a lot in corporate AV work. You know, the clients, Microsofts of the world and the 7-Elevens and whoever who are doing these big conventions, these people don't care what equipment you bring in as long as, you know, the price is in their range and you pull it off and you do it brilliantly. They don't care if the speaker boxes come from Radio Shack, most of them, because that's not what they're buying.
Right.
Which is complete opposite of high level touring. You know, they're coming there primarily for the gear and then they'll take the rest. You know?
Right, right. And so there's a real flip there. Like, for example, when I bought my most recent console, you know, rider friendliness was not a concern at all. It didn't even enter into my decision because I'm not a rental company. Right. I don't care what the rider says. I'm the one using this. So it's literally what tool is going to allow me to do my job the best, the way I see that it should be done. And that's it.
Yeah.
And so it's all about solving the problem and allowing me to, you know, interact with my client and give them what they need. And it's not about someone. People don't come to me and say, we need to rent X boxes of this brand. That's not, you don't call me for that, you know?
No, this is how many people we have. This is where we're doing the event, you know, and please come back with your proposal. And I could tell you from personal experience, having done tons of corporate work, when those clients, when you pull it off and you make those organizers happy, you're in.
Right.
You know what
Absolutely.
I mean? Like, they're not looking for anybody else because their jobs are on the line when they do these things. They put in huge amounts of work and it's a huge risk for them, especially when they step out and bring in somebody different. I mean, one failed event can cost people millions of dollars in, you know, in losses. And it's not hard to imagine that somebody's going to lose their job over that. So when they find somebody that they're comfortable with, and they enjoy working with and they pull it off, the phone will ring again the next time and you don't have to worry about it. That's why you have these Freemans and stuff, because those guys, you know, have made their careers in doing this sort of thing. They know the clients, they know the mentality, and they'll pull it off, you know, every single time.